Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up on a small family Christmas tree farm in Litchfield, Connecticut, and earned a BA degree in political science from New York University. She's an American author, essayist, short story writer, biographer, novelist, who's best known for her 2006 memoir, Eat, Pray, Love, which has sold more than 10 million copies and was made into a film in 2010. Her name? Elizabeth Gilbert. And she was played by Julia Roberts in that film. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, and Love, which has sold more than 10 million copies and was on the New York Times bestseller list for 3.5 years. Liz, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here. How are you?
Terrific. Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a lot to tell, but the thumbnail version of it is that my parents had this dream of living off the land. My mom had grown up on a farm, and my dad had always wanted to. And when we were young, they moved us out to this really dilapidated farmhouse in northwestern Connecticut. And for the next, you know, for the rest of my childhood, that was when I was about four, they made a real effort to live the most self-sufficient life that they possibly could, which meant we had goats and chickens and ducks and huge garden. My parents had a Christmas tree farm, and they only heated the house with wood that they cut themselves, and my mom sewed our clothes and did our haircuts, and everything was done, you know, sort of single-handedly or quadruply-handedly by the two of them. And one of the other features is that we didn't have television, and we lived kind of out in the middle of nowhere. We didn't have any kids around who were the same age as me and my sister. And so I think our childhood was a combination of a lot of physical work and also a lot of responsibility for coming up with our own stories and our own imaginations in which to play, really. So it's kind of not surprising, I guess, that the two of us, my sister and I, both ended up as writers. We were always making up our own lives, and we still are.
Liz, how old were you when you first started to write, and what's the first thing you actually wrote?
I can't remember a time. I mean, I can remember learning how to write, and then from then on, I've been writing. we were writing. My sister and I were constantly writing. We were writing books. We were writing stories. We were writing plays. The first thing I wrote for public consumption was probably a play that I wrote in fifth grade about a girl who goes back in time that I managed to convince the teacher to let us produce in the gymnasium. That was very exciting. I had a very early desire to want to show people what I had written. I've always kind of been like that. So it's not just that it's something that I do privately. I'm kind of a pamphleteer once it's done.
All right. Then you started writing in magazines, Spin, GQ, etc. Tell us about those days, please.
Yeah, that came accidentally, actually. I had never intended to be a journalist. I always wanted to be a fiction writer. And my first publication was a short story, was a piece of fiction that got published in Esquire magazine. And through that, I sort of got entree into the magazine world, and then found out that I could also, you know, people would give me money to tell stories that were true stories, which was pretty incredible to me. For about 10 years, I worked at, worked for a long time at Spin Magazine, a long time at GQ, wrote for the New York Times Magazine and other places as well. My beat tended to be writing long form, nonfiction profiles and essays about very strange or interesting or unusual people. So I spent those years really traveling around the country and the world, finding fascinating characters. And I was thankful enough to be writing in magazines at a time when they would give you the space for that kind of a story. So it was a really wonderful training ground for me as a reporter and as a writer.
I quote you now from a recent article that you wrote, and you said, quote, "It takes just as much effort and passion to write a 15-page story as a 300-page book." I think it was Mark Twain who told a friend that he had to write him a long letter because he didn't have time to write a short one. Liz, please.
Yeah, it's hard to write a short piece. and I think people have this misunderstanding that because something is short, it's easier. And it's really not. I find, for instance, I'm on Facebook every day, and I often write, whatever I'm thinking about, I write on Facebook. And because it's so unedited, and it's just kind of going out into the ether, and I'm pushing send as soon as I'm done with it, that stuff is really sloppily written. It doesn't mean that it's badly written. It just means that I say whatever I want to say in as much space as I would like to use, and then I hit send, and it's done. The difference when you're writing for magazines or when you're writing short stories or small pieces is that you can't do that. You're confined within the margins of the word count and the responsibilities, to the space that's available. And that becomes, then you become a jeweler, right? Then you're sitting there faceting and refaceting and refaceting and refaceting this story and trying to figure out how you're possibly going to say everything that you feel needs to be said in such a small space. And there's something very cramping about that, but there's also something very, lapidary, I would say, about that. What you end up with is sometimes something much harder, shinier, and more beautiful than the original sprawling, messy piece was. But that takes a lot of time. So sometimes it's easier to write the long thing than it is to write the short thing. And sometimes, and this goes for me as well, when writers get successful enough that people don't edit them anymore, you sort of wish somebody would put some margins around them and say, look, you're not allowed to actually use all the pages in the world. Like, I'm going to ask you to narrow this down and be more efficient and get to the point more directly. And I keep trying to remind myself to do that as well.
Liz, some days you wake up and the words just flow. You've got it. You're in the groove. And then other days, you just don't have it. Those days you don't have it, how do you write?
Badly. You write badly, but you do it anyway. And in those cases, to me, there's a very similar correlation between physical exercise and writing in that, if you have any kind of physical exercise practice, that this is also true, right? There are some days where you can get up and go running and it's great and you feel like a deer and birds are singing and you think you could just go forever. And there's another day, maybe that's a few weeks down the line where, like, what it takes you to get your running shoes on and even go plod through a mile or go to the gym for even 15 minutes feels like, a death march. You're just like, how can I do this? I don't think I can get through this. But if you've made the commitment and the contract to engage with that exercise, whether it's a writing exercise or physical exercise, you do what you can, you do what you can. You run as far as you can. You write as far as you can. And for me, on the days when the work isn't flowing, which is most of the days, if I waited to only write on days when the work was flowing, I would have very, very few words having been written in my life. What I do is I set a timer and I just make a deal. And the deal is I'm here for an hour. And when this timer dings, I'm free. And it really does feel like a prison sentence. Sometimes you just sit there and you're like, watching that clock tick. But if you make the deal not to stand up, and you can do anything for an hour, you just make the deal not to stand up. And sometimes around, minute 52, your very bad prose will suddenly lighten up and maybe you'll get a couple good sentences out of it. And then when the clock ticks, you're done for the day and you can go do something else and try again tomorrow. But it's about showing up. I always say most interesting things in the world are 90% boring. Writing to me is the most fascinating thing in the world. And even it, 90% of the time, it's kind of boring. Travel is like my second big passion in life. Fascinating, amazing. Let's be honest, if you've ever gone on a big trip, a lot of it, that trip is kind of boring until there's this one jewel-like moment that you could never have gotten by staying home that was so worth all the trouble that you went through to go there, raising children, I don't have them, but I'm told by my friends, 90% of the time, really boring. And then there are these magic moments where it's kind of incredible. Marriage can be really boring and then transcendent. Anything that's worth doing, exercise again, boring, 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 until suddenly it isn't. So you have to be able to stay with the boring part. And as my friend Pastor Rob Bell always says, don't rush through the experiences that have the most potential to transform you. You know, if you can stay with it through the boring part and come out on the other side, you may come out changed.
We're talking to Liz Gilbert, whose first published book was in 1997 entitled Pilgrims. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Elizabeth Gilbert. Liz, a very painful divorce changed your life, changed the lives of tens of thousands of other people. Talk to us about that period, if you will.
Well, you know, anybody who's been through a divorce knows it's awful. I have a friend who's a private investigator who works on divorce cases in rural North Carolina. That itself is a very interesting life. But he said he feels like the state should give you a identification card when you're going through divorce that allows you to get away with being temporarily insane. And you're allowed to pull that identification card out in various social or business situations. And just, it's your explanation, like, look, I'm losing my mind. because what there's a lovely line by the British novelist Rebecca West that said, getting divorced is very, very nearly always as satisfying as breaking expensive and valuable china. And that's what it feels like. You're breaking a dream that you had with a person. You're breaking a contract and a commitment that you felt certain you were going to be able to honor. You're usually dividing up family or families. You're dividing up friends. You're dividing up property. And the entire trajectory of your life is no longer what you fully expected it to be. And it's very jarring. And it makes people kind of crazy for a while until they can land in a new situation or a new life or become a new person entirely different from what they had originally had in mind. It's terribly painful. You know, in the American Psychological Association, they actually list divorce as the second most stressful life event that people can go through after death of a spouse. It's that devastating to your life. And I think the reason it's also so complicated is because unlike death of a loved one, for instance, your feelings are so messy, you know. There's hate and love, there's longing and aversion. It's never simple. And really I think it's a terribly difficult thing for people to go through.
As you went through it in trying to reclaim yourself and your selfhood, you decided to take a year-long journey to three countries. The first of which is Italy. You spend 4 months in Italy. Liz, what did you do for those 4 months in Italy?
I ate. I did two things. I ate and I learned how to speak Italian. And this was part of my recovery process. I just thought, what would it be like? Because like many of us, especially many women, I spend my life, in a mixed relationship with food. And I just thought, I want to go to a place where people know how to eat. And I just want to feed myself. I think part of it was just this sense of vacancy, this hole within that couldn't be filled. And I know it sounds like I'm advocating for binge eating as a way of getting over emotions, but it wasn't so much binge eating as it was pleasure eating. I wanted to rediscover simple pleasures, simple bodily pleasures. I walked a lot. I just spent months walking around Rome in different Italian cities. I walked until I dropped, and then I would eat until I dropped. and I learned to speak Italian, which is something that I'd always wanted to do. And I think part of that, too, was about finding something else to do with my mind besides ruminating and regretting and being sad and using my brain for a different purpose and filling it with literally a new language that didn't have any negative association. It was very healing time in my life. And I watched a lot of football, Italian football, with my Italian friends. it was really lovely.
After 4 months, you leave Italy 23 pounds heavier. You go to India. Then you spend 3 months in India to do what?
To meditate and to pray. I went to an ashram kind of in the middle of nowhere in India, couple hours outside of Mumbai, and I spent 4 months there just in reflection and in meditation. Now, I'm very glad that I ate and rested and had so much pleasure before I went, because that was a very difficult thing to have done, and I would not have been either physically or emotionally capable of doing it had I gone there first, accidentally or whatever. The order of the trip really seemed to be correct. I got my strength up in Italy and got a lot of sleep, and then I went to India and faced the demons, because that's what meditation is. You know, we all have this sort of dream about meditation that it's going to bring you peace and tranquility and make you more calm. And eventually it will. But along the way, what's going to happen is that you will be forced in a very naked way to have to really look at what's going on inside of your mind and your emotions, and to sit through it and sit with it and endure it and learn how to make some sort of peace accord with it, battling sometimes, surrendering other times. You know, you're really in a room all alone. I mean, it's kind of the biggest nightmare for a lot of people, just being in a room all alone with nothing but your own history to look at and your own thoughts. It was really painful, but I think that's the most important thing I've ever done in my life, is that 4 month trip. I came away from that really with a lot of reconciliation between me and myself, basically.
Then the third country, Indonesia, you spend another 4 months in Bali, and an old medicine man changes your life.
Yeah, that was a bit of a prophecy. I had gone to Bali a couple of years earlier on a magazine assignment, and while I was there, I had met this ninth generation ancient Indonesian medicine man who, at the time, looked like he was 150, and that was 15 years ago. And he's still alive. I think he may literally be ageless. He and I had a little moment. And he read my palm, and he said, "You're destined to come back here and stay here and be part of my family. And this is what's in your future." And you know, when you don't know what you're supposed to do next, which is the situation I was in after my divorce, and a ninth generation Indonesian medicine man who looks like Yoda tells you, you know, that there's a prophecy, you kind of have to do it. That's how I felt. I was like, well, I don't have any better ideas. So I came back. And what I was really looking for in Bali was, I would say, the balance between the two ethics that I had thrown myself into in Italy and India. You know, one was the ethic of worldly pleasure and beauty and sensuality. And the other one was, you know, the ethic of devotion and prayer and a kind of more austere life. And the Balinese really do seem to straddle both of those ethics beautifully. I mean, they love pleasure and they love dance and they love music and they love feasts and they love, you know, they're just beautiful artists of living. And at the same time, you know, tremendously devout in their spiritual practices. And I think they're the people who sort of have it figured out. So I really wanted to go study at their feet.
When we come back, we'll ask Liz Gilbert about something else, another magical item that God gave her as she left Bali. And I'm Jack Rasulin. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasulin, and we're with Liz Gilbert. And there was one other thing that changed your life as a result of 4 months in Bali. A soulmate, your Brazilian lover.
Yeah, that was an unexpected bonus. he's downstairs right now making coffee, actually. That I always like to say that's a happy ending that turned into an even happier ending. Yeah, much to my surprise, I met a wonderful man when I was in Bali, and we fell in love. Both of us were people who had been through very painful divorces. Both of us were not expecting to find somebody again. Both of us kind of came to each other with the same request, which was, please be gentle with me. I've been through some stuff, and we have held on to that commitment of being very gentle with each other. It's a lovely and sweet romance, and remains one. What are we now, 12 years later?
So then you write these experiences down. The name of the book is Eat, Pray, and Love. And 10 million copies later, 3.5 years on the New York Times bestseller list, it changed your life dramatically and the lives of tens of thousands of other people. What amazed you most about that experience?
Oh, my gosh. The whole thing. I mean, you know, what I got out of that year of traveling and taking care of myself and sort of realigning myself was such a treasure that I didn't even need all of that other stuff to happen. You know, I already, it was grace upon grace, you know. I remember when I finished writing the book, and I always talk to my books, I always feel like they have a sort of animate energy to them. I remember when I finished writing the book, you know, living the book and then writing the book were the most transformative things I've ever done in my life. And when I was done writing it, I remember sort of saying to the book, as far as I'm concerned, you've given me enough. You know, like, our work is done here. If you just want to be published and no one will even read you and you just want to sit on a shelf and rest for eternity, that is totally fine with me. No, like, really, we're good. And then, of course, that's not at all what happened. And I think what amazed me and what still amazes me is how many people have used that book as a permission slip to ask themselves, especially women, to ask themselves these very dangerous questions about their lives. You know, what do I really want to be? Is this working for me, the path that I'm on? Am I allowed to change everything? Am I allowed to say, this is not satisfying, and I know that I made these choices, but now I'm going to change the choices that I made when I was a younger version of myself who didn't know better, you know? You're allowed to say, this was a mistaken path, and now I'm going to choose a new one. And you're allowed to kind of throw it all up in the air and start over. Not that it's easy, but that you're allowed to. These are big questions, and for most of history, women haven't been allowed to ask those questions. And you'd be amazed how many women in the United States and across the world still haven't quite gotten the memo that they're permitted to even have that question. And for some reason, and thank goodness for it, Eat, Pray, Love really seemed to push a lot of people to allow themselves that.
And you've just released the latest book called Eat, Pray, Love, Made Me Do It, Life Journeys Inspired by the Best-Selling Memoir, where you write the introduction and 50 writers tell their stories of how this book's changed their life. Tell us about this newest initiative.
Yeah, this is just a special little thing that's come out because it's the 10th year anniversary of Eat, Pray, Love. And my publisher came up with the idea, and I thought it was really lovely. And the nice thing about it, I mean, I'm just delighted that it exists. But, you know, most of the people writing in that book are not professional writers. You know, we put out a call on social media and ask people to share their stories about how Eat, Pray, Love had changed them or what it had encouraged them to do. And you know, you just got this tsunami of responses that we were able to narrow down to just the 50, as you say. And the diversity of voices is extraordinary. Mostly women, but a few men. And, you know, people from all over the world, from all different socioeconomic classes. I think my favorite one is this woman who wrote about leaving a marriage that had just stagnated to the point of utter despair. And she had just been resigned to it the way so many people are, just saying, well, I guess this is what it is, right? You know, too late for me. My life's over. And Eat, Pray, Love caused her to leave. And she had two little children, and she went off on her own as a single mom, and it was really hard and really painful. But she was stepping into some other version of herself that was more appropriate for who she was and who she was meant to be. And she has a lovely line in there where she said, you know, she said most women, a lot of women won't do this because they feel like they're not allowed to and that they can't afford it. And she said, when I read Eat, Pray, Love, you know, of course I wanted to go travel around the world, but she couldn't. She had two little kids. She had no money. She had an expensive divorce. She was starting over. And she said, but I found the things, the book gave me permission to find the things to do for myself that were acts of self-care. So she said, my Italy was going to the gym a few times a week, and my Indonesia was coffee every Saturday with my two best girlfriends, and my, you know, my India was the one weekend that I went away with my sisters, and we had this time together. She said, you know, you can find these things for yourself, even within your own life, if you're committed to growth and if you're committed to self-care. It doesn't mean that you have to go travel around the world for a year, which, let's be honest, most people are simply not going to be able to do.
New book again, Eat, Pray, Love, Made Me Do It. Liz, in 2010, they take this book, Eat, Pray, Love, your book, and they create a movie. And Julia Roberts plays Elizabeth Gilbert. Elizabeth Gilbert, what's that like watching Julia Roberts play you?
Well, it still makes me laugh that it happened at all. It's very, very easy for me to tell the difference between myself and Julia Roberts. So when I'm watching the movie, it's not like I'm like, God, I just don't even know the difference between me and her. It's all just blending, you know. But she did a beautiful job with it. And she's such a soulful presence on the screen and also such a powerful presence in Hollywood. And it was her embrace of that book that made that movie possible. And there aren't that very many women in Hollywood who have that sort of power, who can say, I really want to do this. I really want to tell this woman's story. And it's beautiful and touching. I thought it was lovely. Everyone who was involved with it deeply cared about the material. The cinematography is magnificent. I mean, for me, watching it is like, you know, watching a home movie of the most amazing year of my life, except for that Martin Scorsese's cinematographer shot it. And instead of me being in the picture, they put in somebody, you know, much more attractive. It's fantastic. Who wouldn't want that home movie? But it's beautiful and touching, and it brought a lot of people to the book as well. It's interesting. You know, a lot of times writers complain about Hollywood making movies out of their books, and then, you know, it's not exactly the same as the book. And I always think, well, of course it isn't. That's always how it is. But what happens is that there are a lot of people, non-readers even, right, who saw the book and then, or sorry, saw the movie and then were called to the book. And that's a great piece of grace as well, to have been, you know, given that sort of an audience of people who might not normally go read any book, much less one of mine.
We're talking to Liz Gilbert, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. If you want to learn more, www.elizabethgilbert.com. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Elizabeth Gilbert. Liz, talk to us, if you will, about human creativity.
Well, this is my favorite subject in the world, and it's something I've devoted my entire life to. I think it's the most interesting way you can spend your life is engaged with creativity. And my definition of creative living, my definition of creativity is the collaboration between a human being's efforts and the mysteries of inspiration. And it really is a mystery. You know, we are the only species who does this. It's profoundly weird behavior. There's no other animal on earth who feels the need to make non-necessary things just because it's pleasing. You know, this is a weird way to spend our time. And yet we've been doing it for, you know, at least 100,000 years, if not more. And it seems to satisfy something in us that can't be satisfied any other way. It seems to unfold something within us that can't be unfolded any other way. And it always progresses in a very strange manner, where you bring your efforts and your tastes and your ideas and your work, and then inspiration brings whatever it brings, which usually is some mysterious force that slightly changes what you had in mind and takes it in different directions. And it really is this incredible dance between a human being and a mystery. That's my definition of creativity. My definition of creative living is far simpler. It just says this, that a creative life is any life where you routinely make your decisions based on curiosity rather than fear. And again, not just once, not just twice, not just a few times, but habitually, again and again, when you are given the choice, a sort of fork in the road, and on one hand, a choice of curiosity, and the other hand is fear, you walk down the path of curiosity. That is a life creatively lived. And if you live that way, you will create a life that is itself a work of art. You know, it's not so much about what you then end up making or doing. It's about the fact that you're following your own very specific curiosity in order to create a life that will look like nobody else's. And that also is very worth doing and available, I believe, to everybody.
We're talking to Elizabeth Gilbert, who in 2015 authored Big Magic, Creating Living Beyond Fear. You mentioned the word fear. False expectations appearing real. It paralyzes all of us at times. Talk to us about overcoming your fears.
You know, it's funny. I'm not a big fan of the idea of overcoming your fear. I feel like there's a dialogue about fear in this culture that's that I think isn't very helpful, and that's a dialogue that's about beating your fears, defeating your fears, kicking your fears in the butt, showing your fear who's boss, punching your fear in the face. It's always got this very aggressive language dominating your fear, right? And to me, that never works. I mean, I've tried it, but it never works for me because, as with everything in the world, anything that I fight usually ends up fighting harder, right? So whenever I try to fight or overcome fear, fear very quickly shows me that it's even stronger than I thought. It kind of doubles down, and I always end up losing that battle. What I've done instead is to kind of make friends with it. Anything in life that I've made friends with has gone better than anything in life that I've fought. And the friendship that I have with fear is that I understand where it's coming from. I understand that our fear, which is deep, not very subtle, but very powerful, very deep evolutionary instinct, probably one of the first conscious instincts that we had as we were evolving, is just there to try to protect us from being killed, really. All it is this great big bodyguard trying to help you. And when I know that, whenever I feel fear arise, I usually just thank it for what it's trying to do. I know it's just trying to save me. And I say, I appreciate your service, but I actually don't need you right now because I'm just writing a poem and no one's going to die. Like, my poetry's not good, but it hasn't killed anybody yet. It's not going to kill me. It's not going to kill anyone else. But you're allowed to stay here in the room with me, you know, while I'm doing this, and you're allowed to sound the alarm of panic, but you're not allowed to control this conversation. And you have to understand, too, that fear and creativity are twins. You know, they're conjoined twins. They're always going to be together. If you're trying to live a creative life, every step you take is a step toward the unknown, because your creativity is constantly asking of you and demanding of you that you enter into new realms with unexpected outcomes. And it is natural to understand and to expect that your fear will hate that, just hates that. Your fear's entire job in life is to not let you walk into realms of unexpected outcome, because the fear can't control that and is terribly afraid it's going to end in your death, no matter what it is. And so I've understood that these two things are always going to be side by side. And so I've made a big enough room inside my imagination to hold them both at the same time and to allow them to coexist and to say, I've got plenty of room for my fear. I've got plenty of room for my creativity. I'm never going to be able to get rid of either of them. And in a weird way, I don't want to get rid of either of them. They're all part of the family of who I am. And so I don't overcome fear. I sort of invite it to come along with me. And when I can explain myself to it, it seems to calm down a bit. But it never, ever, ever goes away.
We're talking to Elizabeth Gilbert. I quote you again now, Liz. Ideas are sort of a healthy virus, and they exist outside the body. Please.
Well, anybody who's ever had an idea, which is most of us, knows the feeling of a visitation, right? This is how people have described inspiration for as long as people have been describing things. This is not a new idea. It's a deeply ancient and universal human idea that an idea comes to you. Inspiration comes to you. Inspiration from the Greek to inhale. It comes from outside. It's absolutely what it feels like when that happens. And even very empirical people will use that language, and they'll say, all of a sudden this idea came to me, struck me. Right? How can something strike you from inside you? It can only strike you from outside of you. And there's a physicist, an interview I read recently with him, where he was talking about how there's a debate about whether mathematical theories, for instance, are discovered or invented. And it's his feeling that they are discovered. And that when he's working on a mathematical problem, he can feel the answer out there in the universe already trying to communicate with him, trying to be revealed to him, trying to show itself to him, trying to lead him somewhere. You know, this is what inspiration always feels like. Now, it doesn't mean that you're just passive and you sit there waiting to be struck, right? Your side of the contract is to show up and to show up, you know, as we talked about earlier in the interview, when you said, what do you do when the writing's not going well? Well, you keep writing badly until it goes well again. You know, you just keep showing up with the understanding that inspiration rewards people who are sitting at their desk every day at 6 o'clock in the morning. More likely that inspiration will strike you when you're already working. But I know the difference, and every creator who I've ever met knows the difference between something that comes from me and something that comes to me or through me. And this is the movement of ideas across the universe, just looking for human collaborators.
As our time winds down together this evening, Elizabeth Gilbert, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
It's going to be the same advice I would give to my old ones, which is to follow your curiosity over your fear. It's the simplest advice. I believe in curiosity so deeply. I think curiosity is the alpha and the omega. It's the beginning and the end. It's the channel through which all good things come to us. And it's accessible always, always. We live in a society that really fetishizes the idea of passion, and people are constantly being told to follow their passions, which is very lovely advice if you happen to have one. But a lot of people don't have one, or thought they had one and lost it, or maybe have multiple passions, or maybe are just really still at the age of 60 trying to figure out what they're going to be when they grow up, you know? And to be constantly being told to follow your passion when that's not something that you're feeling can be a really painful piece of advice to receive, you know, and it's like saying it's easy to lose weight. You just have to be born thin, you know. It doesn't help. and so I always tell people, like, look, forget about passion unless you have one, in which case, yeah, follow it. But for the rest of us, which is most of us, just drop it. Just forget about passion and focus instead on curiosity. Curiosity is a smaller impulse. It's more subtle. It's a whisper. It's a tap on the shoulder. Everybody's looking for the big thunderous voice from God that tells you what to do with your life. But I don't think that's how it works. I think it's a trail of breadcrumbs. It's a scavenger hunt. And the curiosity clues are the hints and the guides that will very well lead you to your passion. But you have to not ignore them. And you have to be brave enough to follow them, even when they don't make sense.
Liz Gilbert, what a shining example of how a person's curiosity and passion can change the world. Thanks much for all you do. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Take good care.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahom.